Riley, professor of international and African politics at Ithaca College, and I have to add, the daughter of the great Nobel literature laureate, Wole Soyinka, the first African to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. And thanks so much to Dominic Recchio, Ithaca College student body president, senior majoring in communication management and design. That does it for our broadcast. We have a job opening at Democracy Now! We're hiring a development director to lead our fundraising efforts and on-air graphics operator as well. We're also accepting applications for our internship program. Find out more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
Join Grassroot News as we celebrate the revolutionary music of Fight the Power, Welcome to the Terror Dome, Public Enemy, November 14th from 10 p.m. to midnight. We're going to focus on Public Enemy. Why? Because we should. So join me. Let's fight the power as we chronicle and profile Public Enemy, November 14th from 10 to midnight.
Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, open daily December 17th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade arts, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest, and is located at Southwest Ankeny and NATO Parkway in Waterfront Park. Information at portlandsaturdaymarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 135 people are dead in multiple attacks in Paris.
Walmart workers have launched a nationwide campaign in the lead-up to Black Friday, 2 weeks from today.
The United States military claims to have taken out a key leader of the right-wing group Daesh in Syria. KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 13th, 2015. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta.
The French president has closed the borders of the country and issued a state of emergency in Paris after multiple blasts killed at least 135 people. 100 of those were killed after the audience at a concert hall were taken hostage and the French military attempted a raid. The attacks occurred at multiple sites in several neighborhoods in the French capital. At least two explosions were heard near the Stade de France stadium north of Paris, where a France-German-friendly soccer match was taking place. According to reports, President Hollande was at the game and was evacuated from the stadium soon after reports of the attacks emerged. The bombings look to be a coordinated attack, but it is unknown who is responsible. The Paris attacks came just hours after the United States announced the assassination by drone of Mohamed Emwazi, a leader of the Daesh militant group in Syria. Daesh is known in English by the acronym ISIS.
A targeted U.S. drone strike in Syria has killed Mohamed Emwazi, probably the best-known and most notorious member of Daesh, known in English by the acronym ISIS. Nicknamed Jihadi John, he was a British citizen who appeared in videos taunting and then murdering British, American, and Japanese aid workers and journalists. Wearing all black coverings from head to toe made him recognizable to online internet video viewers, as did his pronounced British accent and cruelty in beheading hostages with a sword on camera. According to the U.S. military, Emwazi was seen this week by surveillance drones as he entered a vehicle. He was then tracked by the three drones that went on to destroy the vehicle with two Hellfire missiles. A Muslim organization in the UK, the Ramadan Foundation, called Emwazi the manifestation of evil and cheered his death. However, the London-based civil rights group CAGE condemned the extrajudicial assassination. The group argued that state-sponsored assassinations without trial undercut judicial processes. According to the human rights group, Emwazi should have been captured and tried as a war criminal.
Washington County Sheriff deputies responded to a call from Jan Larian's family, reporting Jan was suicidal and possibly armed with a knife and handgun. Two deputies fired 9 less-than-lethal rubber bullets at the woman's car after she shot herself so that they could see inside the vehicle. The two deputies never fired lethal rounds at the woman, Hillsborough Police Lieutenant Mike Rauch has said. Previously, police did not release any information about what weapons they fired during the stop. Jan Larian, 57, of Hillsborough, ended her life last Thursday after she shot herself inside her auto. Her family has called the Washington County Sheriff's Office to report that she was self-destructive and perhaps outfitted with a blade and handgun. Deputies spotted her car at the intersection of Southeast River and Minter Brig Roads in Hillsborough. As deputies ordered her out of her car, she fired once, Rauch has said. Either the bullet or shrapnel then hit Deputy Eric Melkin, police said. Not long after Larian fired, deputies let go 40-millimeter less-than-lethal rounds at the windows, and police drew closer to the auto. Larian died at the scene.
Bloomingdale's Corporation has come under fire for an ad which some say promotes date rape. The ad depicts a woman and a man, both dressed in business attire. The woman is smiling, looking over her shoulder to something off camera, while the man is looking at the woman with an intense and serious gaze. The caption reads, "Spike your best friend's eggnog when they're not looking." The ad, printed in Bloomingdale's holiday catalog, provoked a flurry of criticism on social media and the web. Some critics, like Susan Kilbourne, the filmmaker behind the award-winning documentary series Killing Us Softly, America's Image of Women, said that the catalog shows how deep these attitudes run and how unconscious they are. Eventually, the company pulled the ad, saying only that the copy was inappropriate and in poor taste, but without apologizing for the content. Bloomingdale's is the second large company this year to face accusations of promoting rape. In April, Bud Light was criticized for a label on their product that read, "The perfect beer for removing no from your vocabulary for the night."
A lawsuit brought against the state of Texas by the Center for Reproductive Rights will be taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court. It will be the court's first look at abortion law since it upheld a federal banning of late-term abortions in 2007. The American Medical Association and other medical groups, along with 12 state attorneys general, joined the center in asking the high court to take the case. The center claims the real intent of the 2013 Texas law that is being challenged was shutting down abortion providers throughout the state. The law's requirement that abortion clinics maintain costly hospital-grade facilities had the intended effect of shutting down the clinics. The law also stipulated a ban on abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. The number of Texas abortion clinics was reduced from 42 to 19 following the law's passage. If the court rules for Texas, 9 of the remaining facilities would be forced to close as well. 27 million Texans would then be served by only 10 clinics. Attorneys for both sides are likely to present oral arguments to the court in early spring. A decision could come by the end of June 2016.
If you're a college football coach or a university president in Oregon, you're probably doing pretty well income-wise. But if you're an adjunct professor, your income may be so low that you fall below the poverty line. KBOO's Martin Dodge has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Adjuncts are typically paid pretty low salaries. In fact, it's estimated about a third of them are drawing public assistance. Yes, they're on welfare. The American Association of University Professors estimates half of all American professors are now adjuncts. This means adjunct professor Heather Toland has a lot in common with her students and works a second job when she isn't teaching biology at Kamekida Community College.
They are all struggling and working really hard too. It's more about, yep, we're all in this together. That's what it feels like to me. We are dependent on Oregon Health Plan for our health insurance. Thank goodness for it. It's been a rough road.
By cutting full-time teaching positions and replacing them with part-time adjunct instructors, colleges can avoid having to provide such employee benefits as health coverage. Also, as adjunct instructors typically have no tenure, they can easily be released when no longer needed, and they come on the job drawing salaries that often are even less than what fast food workers make. Many of them must hold second jobs to make ends meet. Professors in Poverty is a new documentary that has the field of Professors in Poverty is a new documentary that has the field of higher education buzzing for its look at part-time and adjunct instructors who rely on public assistance. University administrators explain they don't necessarily like this system, but the shrinking budgets provided to them by legislators and the public have put their backs against the wall. Meanwhile, the professors in poverty here in Oregon and across the country say their health, morale, and careers all suffer with the part-time teaching trend. For KBOO News, I'm Martin Watson Dodge.
Students, faculty, and staff at a small Oregon university are up in arms about changes made by management without notice. This past week, more adjunct faculty members at Merrillhurst University were removed from the 2015-16 course schedule without notice. Under the management of President Melody Rose, at least 12 full-time faculty have resigned, retired, or had their departments dissolved this year. This adds up to nearly one quarter of the small university's total number of full-time teachers. Since May 2015, approximately 24 additional adjunct faculty have been removed from the course catalogs. The professors say this was done without consultation with academic department chairs or with the instructors themselves. According to the group Save Our Merrillhurst, in the past 6 months, the university community of students, faculty, staff, and alumni have experienced the elimination of teaching posts, classes, and a major reorganization of academic programs. All of this is being done despite statements by the university president that they are no longer in debt and that enrollment is stable. In October, the Coalition of Students, Alumni, Community Supporters, and Faculty held a campus demonstration protesting the lack of transparency and the absence of faculty input in the decision-making of the Rose management. With the expulsion of teachers, some classes, including those required for students to graduate, have been abruptly canceled. Students are alarmed and have asked the president for a meeting to answer their concerns about disruptions in their degree studies. Alumni are also speaking up about the consequences of upper management's lack of transparency and secretive methods. They blame the leadership of Melody Rose for the gutting of academic programs. More information about the campaign can be found on the Facebook page Save Our Merrillhurst.
Through this weekend, the Oregon Bureau of Land Management is rounding up wild horses in the Bates Butte area near Adel, west of Lakeview. The agency is using helicopters to herd the horses into temporary corrals for shipment to adoption facilities. Critics say it further taxes an already jammed federal wild horse and burro adoption system. KBOO's Demi Hellenius has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
It's been 1 week since the Bureau of Land Management started rounding up wild horses east of Lakeview. Using helicopters, the agency has reached about a third of its goal, capturing close to 450 horses out of a possible 1,500. The BLM says the area is home to about six times more horses than it can support, and that overgrazing is threatening soil stability and sage-grouse habitat. Gail Hunt, with the Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition, says roundups on public land are inevitable when horse populations become difficult to manage. But she says it shouldn't have gotten to that point.
Why wasn't there fertility control? Why wasn't there selective adoptions? You know, strategic captures where you have opportunities to perhaps bait trap, which is a normally far less traumatic way to catch the horse.
Another organization, the American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign, has suggested ranchers don't want their cattle competing for food in this 625-square-mile herd management area. The campaign threatened legal action and was granted daily public access to view the horse-gathering activities. The BLM says it plans to return only about 100 horses to Bates Butte near Adel, which the agency says is the low end of its target management numbers. For the rest, Hunt says their future may no longer be wild, but it isn't always bleak. First, they are branded, wormed, and vaccinated.
They'll do a health check. You know, if there's any problems, whether injury or illness, you know, they're going to address that. Normally, they're separated by gender, sometimes by age, and then they're put up for adoption.
Most will end up at the BLM Wild Horse Adoption Corrals near Burns or at Palomino Valley near Reno, Nevada. Critics of the roundup say there are already 50,000 horses and burros in the system and point out that not all potential adopters have the best intentions for the animals. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
It's only 8 weeks until the end of the year. That's a very short time for Congress to pass legislation approving the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement that's been a decade in the making. Without approval, the agreement expires on December 31st. KBOO's David Kesters has more in association with the Oregon News Service.
Time is running out for Congress to pass the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. But at the White House Tribal Nations Conference late last week, there were glimmers of hope that it could still be possible. President Obama told the group he's committed to working with tribal nations to protect natural resources and honor their heritage. Kathy Hill with the Klamath Tribes was there and says she heard mixed views about the future of the water agreement.
Sally Jewell was optimistic, but then another person, not with the administration, told me, you know, nothing's going to get through this house this year. And you know, that's the mood, I think, maybe in Washington, D.C.
The agreement governs water use in Southern Oregon and Northern California. It was hammered out by more than 40 parties, but it expires at the end of this year without congressional approval. The Senate bill is stalled until a companion House bill is introduced. For that, all eyes are on Congressman Greg Walden, who has said it's a priority. Parts of the agreement affect more than Oregon and California. It calls for the removal of four older dams in the region. But if the agreement expires, PacifiCorps could upgrade and relicense the dams instead, passing the costs on to ratepayers in a half dozen states. Greg Adelton, who heads the Klamath Water Users Association, says for irrigators, it was a critical compromise.
We shook hands on that deal, and we're still committed to that outcome. if the agreement goes forward. We don't want to go back and do this all over again. We don't even know if we can do it all over again. We've really tried to convey that sense of urgency to Congress. Hopefully they hear us.
But Kathy Hill wonders if lawmakers unfamiliar with Oregon's water wars understand the importance of the agreement.
With climate change and everything that's going on, this is something positive that people felt like they were doing for the future of their communities. So it concerns me that there's so much misunderstanding that I think could really be what causes some problems.
She hopes members of Congress will see it as a successful local model for negotiations on tough topics, and that they'll vote for it if they get the chance. For KBOO News, I'm David Kesters.
Evening. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for media analysis on the week's news on Counterspin, produced by the Media Watch Group Fair. Then Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area will be rainy with a high of 58 and a low of 43. Sunday will be rainy and cooler with a high of 48 and a low of 39. Today in history, on November 13, 1969, thousands of Vietnam War protesters began a march against death in Washington, D.C. The peaceful demonstration was sponsored and organized by the New Mobilization Committee to end the war in Vietnam. Despite the mass mobilization and repeated marches and protests in D.C. and across the country, the war would continue for another 6 years before it finally came to an end in 1975. 20 years after it began. The quote of the day is from Pakistani politician and cricket player Imran Khan, who said, "The war on terror is the most insane and immoral war of all time. The Americans are doing what they did in Vietnam, bombing villages. But how can a civilized nation do this? How can you eliminate suspects, their wives, their children, their families, their neighbors? How can you justify this?" You're playing cold music on the barroom floor.
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Imagine if retailers held a nationwide super spectacular sales day and no one came. I don't mean customers, but that sales staff, cashiers, and even managers wouldn't show up to open the doors for the usual sale-a-mania frenzy of mass, crass, crazy consumerism. But that's silly, of course. Even slightly un-American to think that stores wouldn't open to cash in on a hugely promoted retail bonanza. Yet there it is. REI, the national purveyor of outdoor gear and sporting goods, says it will no longer participate in the shopping spectacle called Black Friday, the day of nonstop doorbuster sales that now overwhelms Thanksgiving. This holiday is meant to be a calm, family-oriented time to get away from all the hubbub of life and reflect on our blessings. But in recent years, such national chains as Macy's and Walmart have led a corporate assault on Thanksgiving with a buy-buy-buy blitz of consumer come-ons. "Rush to the mall," shout the barrage of Black Friday ads, enticing us to reduce our values to the shallow concept of monetary value, i.e., lower-priced stuff. They've turned this contemplative day of thanks into a weekend of worshiping mammon. "Enough," says REI, the retail co-op with 143 stores and $2.2 billion a year in sales, is raising the ethical bar by canceling its participation in Black Friday. Instead of shopping on the Thursday and Friday of Thanksgiving weekend, REI is urging its employees and customers to break out, literally. Take a walk with family and friends, enjoy a bike ride, visit a public park, and otherwise get outside the soul-suffocating syndrome of constant consumerism. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a concept. Don't shop, live. Connect with people, nature, the spirits, and yourself. For more information, go to optoutside.rei.com.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The University of Missouri has appointed a new interim president. After a month of protests calling for racial justice on campus, President Tim Wolf resigned. Taking his place is Michael Middleton, a black civil rights attorney and longtime administrator at the university. The appointment comes after protests from the student activist group Concerned Student 1950, the name of the first black student that was admitted there. A hunger strike from student Jonathan Butler, as well as a threat of boycott from the university's football team, brought the protests into the national spotlight, pressuring Wolf to resign earlier this week. Middleton's appointment has come with strong support from student activists. They had met previously with members during the protests. At the conference to announce his employment, his appointment, Middleton spoke about feeling that his 30-year career had been a failure in light of recent events on campus, and he remarked that he had felt marginalized every day. He's promised to work closely with activists to combat racial inequality. Although he has said he does not plan to seek permanent placement as president, his interim presidency may give him more flexibility in implementing broad changes in the university.
Senators Bernie Sanders and Tammy Baldwin have introduced legislation to stop the transfer of federal land to a foreign-owned corporation. The land known as Oak Flat is located in the Tonto National Forest and has significant religious and cultural value to Apaches and other Native Americans in the region. The company, Rio Tinto, plans to develop the land into the largest copper mine in North America. The Save Oak Flat Act, if passed, will repeal a section of the National Defense Authorization Act that approved the Southeast Arizona Land Exchange Act. That provision was added to the 1,700-page bill the night before it came up for consideration. The land exchange circumvents existing federal protections for Native American sacred and cultural areas. The companies who will receive the land under the deal, Rio Tinto PLC and its subsidiary Resolution Copper, will reap tens of billions of dollars in U.S. taxpayer assets from the exchange. The proposed mine will collapse the surface of the land, destroying forever a Native American place of worship and threatening our first Americans' traditions and ways of life. A similar bill has been introduced already into the House of Representatives, and the legislation currently has 36 bipartisan co-sponsors.
A Walmart worker group has launched a new protest in its ongoing fight for increased pay and benefits in the Walmart organization. The protest began yesterday. It's being led by a former United Food and Commercial Workers International Union employee with expectations of 1,000 people across all 50 states to participate. The protest will last 15 days, leading to Black Friday, an important shopping day following Thanksgiving. As part of the protest, workers are asking for a $15 an hour minimum wage and more opportunities to work full time. According to the group, more than 100 workers will fast and organize outside stores, offices, and executives' homes. Walmart has received regular criticism for low wages and poor working conditions. The company has made ripples throughout the retail industry earlier this year when it increased its minimum pay to $9 an hour. Walmart has said it will raise wages further to $10 an hour for current employees by February of next year. Walmart is the largest company in the world.
A federal appeals court has removed one of several obstacles to resuming executions in California. The panel of federal judges struck down a lower court ruling that the state's snarled capital punishment system is arbitrary and unconstitutional. In overturning last year's ruling, the panel did not squarely address whether California's death penalty is so dysfunctional that it violates the U.S. Constitution. The opinion from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit addressed the case of inmate Ernest DeWayne Jones, who was sentenced to death in 1995 for the murder and rape of his girlfriend's mother. When the appeal finally reached federal court 19 years later, Carney ruled that California's appeal system was plagued by, quote, systemic delay and dysfunction, end quote. His lawyers argued that the dysfunctional system in California makes executions so rare that they're random and thus unconstitutional. The taxpayer-supported habeas corpus resource center must decide whether to appeal to a larger panel of the Ninth Circuit or to the U.S. Supreme Court or both. In the meantime, California probably remains years away from resuming executions, which were halted in 2006.
Today's Friday the 13th. To honor the occasion, fans of the movie Friday the 13th and other horror flicks are gathering at the Portland Convention Center this weekend for the Walking Dead convention. Actor Adrian Rich, who played the sole survivor of Jason in the original Friday the 13th film in 1980, stopped by KABU Studios to tell us about the event.
It's a crazy, scary kind of dress-up convention at the convention center. It's called The Living Dead. It's their first annual. And I was walking by and somebody said, come tell us about it. So, yeah, it should be fun. Lots of Twin Peaks people from the series and the movie and everything. And should be a lot of fun all weekend long.
So you yourself were a child actor?
I was, actually, but I did a lot of stage back when I was a child, and then one of my first movies was Friday the 13th, and I'm still around to talk about it. It was kind of crazy, though. And the kid who played Jason in the first movie is actually at the convention this weekend, too. His name's Ari Lehman, and he plays in a band called First Jason, which is pretty funny because he was. And so he'll be there, too. But there's going to be a ton of really cool people that you wouldn't normally find all in one place in Portland, you know, maybe scattered about. And I live in Southern Oregon, so it was my joy to come up here and be present for James Beach and Deanna, who are throwing it, and all the wonderful happy campers I have up here. How's that? I hope to meet each and every one of them. And I've brought some of my Crystal Lake wine, guys, so come on by.
Wow. And so if people see characters walking around town that look like they're straight out of a horror movie this weekend.
They probably are.
When you filmed Friday the 13th, did you have any idea how big it would get?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, the first one was a low budget one and we almost ran out of money like three times.